Wednesday, June 8, 2022. You are listening to the Daily Dose Sports Podcast, and I am your host, Clint Daly, coming to you from the Mile High City here in Denver, Colorado, and we are back for another week of talking sports with a dose of common sense. Hey, happy Wednesday to you. I hope your week is off to a strong start. I hope you, your family, your friends, you're all staying strong, you're all staying healthy, and I know we say it every week, but, you know, mentally as much as physically right now. And, you know, I've actually had a few people ask me, why do I say that every week? Why do I say, I hope everyone out there is staying strong physically and mentally? Why do I say that? What is that about? Well, I want you to think about all that is going on in the world right now. And I'm telling you right now, don't dwell on it. Don't like stay on it because you'll get all depressed. I just want you to think about it. Let your mind drift over there briefly. I mean, right now, in 2022, there's some weird things going on, right? We have war in Europe. We have a person over in Europe who might be completely crazy. We have a world still recovering from a global pandemic and all of the mental health and financial problems that the pandemic caused. Here in the United States, gas prices are at an all-time high, as are homelessness, and parents can't even find baby formula right now. And worst of all, our own president is busy trying to remember what shoe he left his afternoon yogurt in or whatever.
We can't rebuild our economy and meet this climate crisis.
And for all of the scary stuff that is going on right now in this world, what do we care the most about? Johnny Depp and old poopy pants. Welcome to 2022, kids. So I said it last week. I will say it again. I hope you and your family and your friends are all staying strong. You're all staying healthy during this very weird and very, very odd time in the world right now. Hey, before we jump in today, just want to remind you, be sure you're stopping by DailyDoseSports.com. We have new articles going up every week. We have links to the podcast. We have links to the video. We even have links to the Daily Dose gear. You can find all of those things over at DailyDoseSports.com. Plus, I am dropping an article typically on Tuesday morning. We drop Daily Doses. It's a very, very quick read. Our featured columnist, Young Jimmy, he usually drops an article on Thursdays. A number of different subjects, but a lot of new things going up over at DailyDoseSports.com. So make sure that you are checking that out each and every week. Hey, today on the show, I actually got a number of sports news stories that I do want to get to today. A lot of things to talk about this week. But then those NBA finals are rolling, and we've got a number of different directions to go on those. We're going to drill down on the NBA finals, talk a little bit about how they're going and how they may end up before it is all said and done. Plus, we will have a Daily Dose Top 5 for you today. You never know which direction the Daily Dose Top 5 is going to go, but you always have to be sure that you stick around and find out. Before we get to any of that, though, let's jump into some breaking news. Kids, we are going to start off in the world of soccer this week. And in nearly 8 years of doing the Daily Dose, I don't think I've ever said those words before. But we do have some news to discuss, and it isn't even American soccer. This is actually soccer from Spain, because Barcelona soccer star Gerard Piqué has broken up with his longtime girlfriend. Now, you may hear that and think, big deal. Soccer stars break up with their girlfriends like every single day. Well, this is a little bit different. Because the 35-year-old soccer star has been dating pop sensation Shakira for the past 12 years. In fact, the couple has two children together. But Spanish newspapers report that the 35-year-old soccer player is unleashed. He's out of control. They say he is partying all over at Barcelona hotspots, where he has been seen accompanied by numerous other women. And wait for it, that Shakira actually caught this clown cheating on her with a 20-year-old restaurant hostess. Wait, it's going to get worse, because this is the statement that Piqué released after the breakup. And no, I'm not even joking about this. Here's what he had to say. I cheated on my girlfriend, but I never cheated on Barcelona, and I never will. I am here to stay two more years and win it all. Did he just say that he never cheated on Barcelona? Did he just say he never had sex with other soccer teams? What exactly is he saying there? How would you cheat on Barcelona? I don't even understand what he's talking about here. You're stepping out on one of the most beautiful, talented, sexy women on the planet with, what, a 20-year-old restaurant hostess? Kids, I think this is one of those commentaries on gender. And I know we aren't really supposed to be talking about genders right now in this day and age. That's all very taboo. It's all very gender fluid. We don't really want to say, hey, sometimes these stereotypes are true, but sometimes they really are true. Some of these old gender stereotypes, they are actually true, no matter how much we try to act like they aren't. Because no matter how beautiful a woman is, no matter how intelligent she is, how sexy she might be, no matter how hard she works for that relationship, never forget, some guy somewhere is completely tired of her nonsense.
Why are you pulling me? I'm right.
Let's move over to the NBA, and we're going to be talking quite a bit of NBA today. You know, after an uptick in television ratings during the regular season and into the playoffs, Game 1 of the NBA Finals yet didn't do so good. In fact, this year's Finals opener between the Boston Celtics and the Golden State Warriors on ABC was the least watched Game 1 held in June since back in 2007. I mean, that was 15 years ago. And according to Sports Media Watch, Game 1 of the Celtics-Warriors series drew just a 6.3 share average with only 11.9 million viewers. That topped the previous two finals, but remember, the previous two finals weren't so good. I mean, each of those two finals were held at odd times for the league. They had to change their calendar around. They had to move things around for COVID. So now things are back to normal, but once again, the ratings are in the toilet, which did actually surprise me a little. I mean, Warriors versus Celtics, that's a solid finals matchup, right? So either people are holding a grudge against the league for some of their past nonsense, maybe the wokeness, the fact that the players don't even really seem to want to play all that much, or people have been watching the playoffs up to this point and decided, like I have, these games are so boring and they're so dull. And they're so manipulated by the officials that I don't know that I want to watch them. And as soon as one team gets a lead, the other team seems to quit. So why watch? The NBA playoff margin of victory so far has been double digits. That's not very fun to watch. And right now, people aren't watching. The NBA has a bit of a problem. And the only way to fix it may be something like requiring a minimum number of games in order for players to even qualify to be an NBA All-Star, which would affect their paychecks. I don't think the league has the guts to do it. I'm sure Adam Silver, the commissioner, doesn't have the guts to do it, but that actually might help a little bit. And the NBA has some things they need to work on. And you know what? We might have a little more to say about this a little bit later in the show. It was also announced that Utah Jazz coach Quinn Snyder has resigned after 8 seasons with that franchise. The team announced that on Sunday. Jazz ownership and management apparently spent several weeks trying to get Snyder to come back as head coach. They even offered a contract extension, but he said the time had come to step down from that job. Now, Snyder actually had 2 years left on his deal, including his own option on the final year of that contract. Snyder actually underwent hip surgery after their season ended, and he's been recuperating, trying to get himself back to full health. If he does decide to make himself a candidate for other coaching jobs, it is expected Quinn Snyder would be very, very high priority for almost any team that would have an opening. Snyder had a 372-264 record in his 8 seasons with the Jazz. That matches the Golden State Warriors' Steve Kerr for the third longest tenure with a team among active head coaches. They only trailed San Antonio's Greg Popovich and Miami's Eric Spoelstra. Now, Snyder's 372 wins are the second most in Jazz history, trailing Hall of Famer Jerry Sloan, who of course won over 1,100 with the Utah Jazz. But does this make anyone else wonder if Quinn had resigned just a little bit earlier, if maybe the Los Angeles Lakers would have gone after him as their next head coach? Is that just me? I don't think it is. But you know what? Now they're saying all-star guard Donovan Mitchell is concerned about the way the franchise is going. Remember, Donovan Mitchell really liked Quinn Snyder. He considered him a significant part for committing to a new five-year contract extension. He did that back in 2020. Now Mitchell says he's trying to process what the departure of Snyder is going to mean to him. I mean, I guess that's understandable. You signed to stay in Utah because you really like your head coach, so you sign a long-term deal to stay with that club. Then again, after watching these latest playoffs, if I'm the Jazz, I might also be wondering about the future of Donovan Mitchell. Because remember, after he averaged 32 points a game last year in the playoffs, he only averaged 25 points a game this year. And you could see his body is breaking down a lot. You wonder if he can hold up because he has taken a lot of abuse. And the way he plays, physical, he goes inside, he attacks the basket. You wonder how long Donovan Mitchell can do that. Hey, the Utah Jazz might be headed for a little transition. Let's move over to the NFL, where we had a couple of NFL retirements this past week. 39-year-old running back Frank Gore's NFL career has officially come to an end as he announced he would be retiring after 16 seasons. You'll remember the first 10 of those seasons came with the San Francisco 49ers. And in those 10 years, Frank Gore was the most productive running back to ever play for San Francisco. He became the franchise's all-time leading rusher with nearly 12,000 rushing yards and 64 rushing touchdowns. And even though he finished his career in four different cities, Gore's legacy is still pretty firmly planted in San Francisco. Last week, he actually signed a one-day contract with the team so that he could retire as a San Francisco 49er. He will be inducted into the team's Eddie DeBartolo Senior Hall of Fame at a game during the upcoming season. Frank Gore finishes his career with 16,000 rushing yards on the dot. 16,000. That is third all-time in NFL history behind Hall of Famers Emmitt Smith and Walter Payton. And among his many accolades, Gore was a five-time Pro Bowler, a second-team All-Pro in 2006, and a member of the NFL's All-Decade team for the 2010s. Quite the storied career for a guy that back in 2005 was a third-round draft pick. And don't forget, he dealt with injuries in college when he came out of Miami. Because Frank Gore, not once, but twice, tore his ACL in his left knee when he was in college. But the 49ers took a chance on him. And that was a chance that worked out very, very well for both sides. Now, Frank Gore most certainly is going to eventually be going to Canton in the future. He will first be eligible for the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 2027. And yet, can you name like one memorable play in Frank Gore's career? Can you remember one year that anyone was saying, hey, Frank Gore is the best running back in the league? Can you literally name anything memorable about Frank Gore's career other than the fact that it was a really, really long career? Probably not, honestly. Now, is Frank Gore a Hall of Famer? Yeah, I guess so. He has the numbers. He has the longevity. He has those 16,000 yards. So, yeah, I guess so is the answer. And honestly, that's probably the answer that Hall of Fame voters will have when they vote for him. They'll say, well, should Frank Gore be in the Hall of Fame? And they'll go, yeah, I guess so. That's just kind of how Frank Gore's career seems to be. But it wasn't just Frank Gore that announced he would be hanging it up, because Ryan Fitzpatrick, also known as Fitzmagic, is also calling it a career after 17 seasons in the NFL. They say Ryan Fitzpatrick is now in deep talks to become an analyst on Amazon Prime Video's Thursday Night Football coverage, and Fitzmagic would be joining a studio team, which they are saying will include Marshawn Lynch, Tony Gonzalez, and Richard Sherman. Don't forget, Amazon already hired Al Michaels and Kirk Herbstreit to be their game broadcasters. Hey, Amazon is putting together quite a team over there, and I actually think Ryan Fitzpatrick would be pretty good at it. He's a pretty smart guy. He's got a ton of experience, and he was a very, very interesting player in the NFL. Fitzmagic, of course, was a fan favorite, well, at least off the field, not always on the field. On the field, he was known more for his prolific beard. But was Ryan Fitzpatrick's career a success? I mean, he came in as a seventh-round pick out of Harvard, which we got rammed down our throat. Hey, he went to Harvard. Hey, he went to Harvard. Every chance they got. Great. But seventh-rounders, they don't make it very long. This guy made it 17 years? Fitzpatrick, on the field, he was an on-and-off starter. Over the course of his career, he spent time with the Rams, the Bengals, the Bills, the Titans, the Texans, the Jets, the Buccaneers, the Dolphins, and Washington. He started games for all nine of those teams, which is a record among NFL quarterbacks. But most will remember his 2015 season with New York when he was a member of the Jets, where Fitzpatrick actually guided the New York Jets to a 10-6 record. They just barely missed the playoffs that year. But that season saw Fitzpatrick have a career high for a single season with nearly 4,000 yards. He threw 31 touchdowns, and we all remember him shredding the Philadelphia Eagles in week 2 that year. Fitzpatrick threw for 402 yards. He had 4 touchdowns. Hey, Ryan Fitzpatrick sometimes got it done on the field. A lot of times didn't get it done on the field. But I will say this. He was one of the coolest guys in the post-game press conference. Remember? He'd have the shirt unbuttoned. He'd have the sunglasses on. He'd be showing the chest hair. He was a pretty cool guy, at least in the press conference. He finishes his career with nearly 35,000 passing yards. That actually ranks 32nd all time and ranks 8th among active quarterbacks. He had 223 career touchdown passes, which ranks 36th all time, tied with the Vikings' Kirk Cousins. But again, I ask the same question. Is Ryan Fitzpatrick a Hall of Famer? I guess you could put like an exhibit in the Hall of Fame with all of his jerseys. He played for 9 teams, but no, he probably isn't. Overall, Ryan Fitzpatrick had a 59-87-1 record. He never even played in a playoff game. So this past week, we had 2 longtime players retire. Were they great players? I don't know. Frank Gore was a longtime player. He was a good player. Ryan Fitzpatrick was a longtime player. He was a little less than good. Were either one of them great? I'm not so sure about that. Kind of an odd week for NFL retirements. So, there are now 24 women claiming quarterback Deshaun Watson engaged in sexual misconduct during his physical massages. The 24th civil suit was filed in Harris County, Texas, just days after the 23rd suit was filed in the same venue. This suit, like all the others, recounts a massage session in which the new Cleveland Browns quarterback demanded a massage therapist work on his inner thighs and quadriceps, and eventually became aggressive, and then the session began to go higher and higher up his inner thigh. I'm going to go throw up now. The 23rd woman filed last week. Now we have 24, and all of the allegations coming out, they're all eerily similar in what they say happened. And remember that the Cleveland Browns traded 3 first-round picks for Watson back in March. They gave him a 5-year, $230 million contract. This is getting worse all the time. And you would have to think, with Watson refusing to settle out of court, all of these things could be dragged through court for years. It may be a long time before Deshaun Watson ever sees the football field. Do the Browns get any sort of like a lemon clause in that contract? Because I'm starting to wonder if they have purchased something that they're never going to be able to drive. You would have to think. The Browns did do their research before they did this deal, right? Then again, this is the Browns. I mean, we talked about it last week. Red Right 88. The drive. The fumble. Art Modell and the move. This all actually kind of makes weird sense for the Browns, doesn't it? Also last week, the National Football League and the NFL Players Association have removed their COVID protocols. They're putting an end to the mask wearing, the testing, the social distancing, and other pandemic-era restrictions. This offseason, a topic of discussion for the NFL Management Council was whether the league needed to reinstate those protocols, as we have seen COVID cases start to spike a little bit. Well, last Thursday, the council decided it was time to take another step towards getting back to normal. They are doing away with all that COVID surveillance ahead of this upcoming season. The league council also opted to eliminate testing and other COVID protocols for unvaccinated and vaccinated players alike. And I realize there's going to be a lot of people that hear this news. And a lot of them are going to view this news as the NFL, being irresponsible, being in denial of COVID or whatever. I don't look at it that way. I really don't. I view it as the NFL is the pro sports league that has handled the pandemic the best of everyone. And they are crushing the TV ratings. Remember, everyone said you can't have the draft right during the dead center of the pandemic. They had a draft. They did it through distance, but they still had their draft. They said you can't possibly play games. They did it. You can't possibly have playoffs or a Super Bowl. And yet the NFL did it this last year. They brought everyone back for the NFL draft. It was packed again. We haven't heard these massive flare-ups coming from the draft. So I think the public actually kind of likes that the NFL has used some common sense in dealing with this pandemic. We spoke a little bit about the NBA earlier. Remember, during that bubble season that the NBA had, where their ratings went down the toilet, the NBA had mandatory testing in a bubble. Everyone wore masks. They could play and physically touch each other, but then they weren't allowed to shake hands after the game, and they had to sit 6 feet apart on the benches. I believe that the NFL has won with their handling of COVID, and they have won by a long shot over the NBA, and they have a lot of really, really good TV ratings to show for it. Finally, the 2023 edition of the Madden NFL video game franchise will feature the iconic John Madden on the cover for the first time since back in 2000. EA Sports announced last week that Madden will be on the cover of all three editions of their game, which is set to be released later this year in August. Of course, Madden, the Hall of Fame NFL coach who died last December, was originally on the cover of then what was called John Madden Football. That was released back in 1988. But Madden lent his commentary alongside Pat Summerall and Al Michaels until the introduction of Xbox 360 and the PS3 in 2006.
Touchdown!
But this year, each of the three covers will showcase a different Madden. They will have one with his time as a coach, one with his time as a broadcaster, and a callback to the original John Madden Football. And then the final one will be on the all Madden version, with Madden bursting through a diagram of X's and O's on a chalkboard. Now, for those of you who play the Madden video game franchise, the game will once again have some of those Madden features that have become standard with this franchise. Your quarterback will throw interceptions constantly. Your offensive lineman will not block the person in front of them. Receivers with a perfect 100 pass catch rating will drop balls again and again. You'll get random bizarre fumbles. Player ratings that make no sense whatsoever. Defensive linemen that are capable of chasing down your fastest skill position players. Look, all these goofy things that come with the Madden franchise, they're not a knock on Madden in any way. He created a franchise that has been one of the most influential and respected franchises in video game and sports history. But you can clearly see the influence of the video game nerds that have completely screwed this franchise up, because as usual, the nerds, whether it's Hollywood or Silicon Valley, they don't understand sports. And so they put a bunch of nonsense in that has no business being there. Yes, I'll probably still play Madden this next year. And yes, I'll also expect that the video game nerds will make this game a much, much worse game than it should be, rather than if they just let Madden make a realistic football game like he intended originally. Okay, coming back. The NBA Finals are rolling along, and while they aren't getting very good TV ratings, we're going to take a look at some very important factors in these finals, and we're going to be making our prediction for who is going to be coming out on top when this is all over. So game two of the NBA Finals was Sunday night. We've got game three coming tonight. And once again on Sunday night, we got another blowout. The Golden State Warriors answered the bell this time. They reminded us why they have been NBA champions before. The Warriors exploded for 35 points in the third quarter. They blew out the Boston Celtics 107-88. Game three tonight will be in Boston, and that series is now tied at one game each. You'll remember Boston won game one in the Bay Area after they actually allowed Steph Curry to hit 6 3-pointers in the opening quarter. But then, after trailing by 15 in the third quarter, the Celtics outscored the Warriors 40-16 in the fourth, and they stole home court advantage. And I know the TV ratings haven't been very good, but I'm telling you, this should be, okay, maybe not a good matchup, but it should be an interesting matchup. We have some contrasting styles in this series. And let's get one thing clear here. We have seen both of these teams look terrible at times this year. The Warriors have had injuries, but it's more than just that. Their defense at times has really big lapses. And while Steph Curry is playing at an MVP kind of level, Klay Thompson, don't get me wrong, he's still dangerous, but he doesn't look like the player he was. He's definitely not the defender he was. And so far, he's not splashing those long-distance threes like he used to. Boston has had their own struggles at times. Remember, Boston was actually under 500 at the start of the new year. They were 25-25 through the first 50 games of the season. But then, first-year head coach Ime Udoka got his feet under him, and the Celtics have just kind of got rolling. But it wasn't just early in the year for both of these teams. Don't forget, the Golden State Warriors lost to the Memphis Grizzlies in Game 5 of their second-round series by like 50. I don't know what happened. Golden State decided they didn't want to play that night. And it's not just Golden State. Boston has blown leads, has gotten beat by teams that you're looking at going, what are they doing? I mean, remember Game 7 of those Eastern Conference Finals against Miami? They blew a big lead there. They had to hold on for dear life to beat the Miami Heat. I don't know that the Miami Heat are really all that good. So both of these teams obviously have strengths. And both of them also very clearly have flaws too. So let's take a look at both of these teams. When I look at the Boston Celtics, a team that has a ton of history, but in recent years, they've kind of been unable to win the big game. They have youth, they have size. And the size that they have allows Boston to switch a lot of screens defensively. That can be valuable because there's a lot of times we don't have to fight through things. Hey, we can just change. We're all kind of the same size anyways. And so the mismatches you're hoping to create with your screening game, sometimes they don't work against Boston. The Celtics have some shooters. They have some depth. Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown are one of the most potent tandems in the NBA, and they play well at both ends of the floor. But these Celtics are actually more than just those two players. Veteran big man Al Horford, he is very capable of giving you paint scoring or stepping outside, stretching your defense a little bit, and opening up the middle for other players to attack the basket. Shooters like Grant Williams and Derek White, they can enter the game. They can dial up scoring from long range too. Point guard Marcus Smart can be a pain defensively. He plays hard every single night. Now, the questions I have for Boston, honestly, they don't really have that much to do with talent. I think they have plenty of talent. Sometimes, though, I worry about Boston's toughness. I worry about their confidence to actually win big games. Now, maybe they vanquished that dragon against the Miami Heat, but I'm not fully convinced. I believe the Boston Celtics will have to prove in this series that with the game hanging in the balance, they can get clutch stops, they can defend the pick and roll, and they can score clutch baskets when they have to. No question. The Boston Celtics are physically talented. To me, this is more of a mental battle for Boston. And I want to see if they're up to being mentally strong enough to get past the Golden State Warriors. Hey, you're going to have some battles if you're going to win a title. They've overcome some battles so far to get this far, but now you got to do it in the finals. Are they capable of getting it done with the brightest lights at the NBA Finals against a very, very competitive team? That's what I'm waiting to see. On the other side, we have those Golden State Warriors, a team that has gone to 6 NBA Finals in the past 8 seasons. That's insane. Of course, they have Steph Curry, they have Klay Thompson, and they have changed the game with their ability to just shoot you out of the game. When Steph and Klay are clicking and they're knocking down three-pointers, it can be a long night and the game can get away from you really, really fast. But it isn't just the Splash Brothers. Draymond Green, yes, he's lost, well, at least a step, maybe more. But he's still a pain. And he still finds ways to make plays and make the Warriors' defense look better than sometimes I actually even think it is. They've also got Jordan Poole, a kid that is kind of turning into like an honorary Splash Brother. Jordan Poole can dial up long-range damage. He can attack you inside. He can do a number of different things. Golden State has Otto Porter. They've got Andrew Wiggins. And just back from that elbow injury, they've got Gary Payton II. And I actually think Gary Payton II is pivotal to the worst because he gives them a stopper that they don't have. You saw when he went down with that injury against the Memphis Grizzlies, how upset the Warriors were. I don't think that was just a coincidence. I think they're looking at Gary Payton II and they're saying, hey, that is the guy that could put us over the top and help us win a title because of the way he defends people. The Warriors are still winning the way that they used to. They spread you out. They attack matchups. And just when you're feeling good, you're down by one, you're down by two, suddenly they go on a 14-2 run. They blow the game wide open. They knock down a few threes. And then, just when you start sprinting to the three-point line and trying to run them off that line, they back cut you and they get easy layups. They get you in foul trouble. We know the Golden State Warriors are a load. They're going to be a pain. The questions I have about Golden State, they are less mental and they are a lot more physical. For one, the Warriors are older. They are not the players they used to be. They don't defend like they used to. At times, it looked to me like Boston can get all the open looks they want and that maybe they can wear the Warriors down in the paint and then use some of their shooters to knock down some shots outside too. The Warriors have to play much bigger than they are and they have to play really, really hard. We saw that in game 2. The Warriors came out and they played hard every possession. But the question I have, is Golden State physically capable of doing that another 3 times to get 4 wins? Now, there are a few keys I believe we will need to watch over this series. Take your eyes off the ball a little bit. The off-ball action is actually very, very interesting. Will the Boston Celtics put Jason Tatum on Draymond Green? Will they put Jaylen Brown on Draymond Green? And whoever they put on him, can they stand up to the nonstop talking, to the physicality, to him yelling at them? Will Green intimidate Boston like he did in game two? Because in game two, oh, he did. He yelled at them. He played physical, and the Celtics stared at him and blinked and went, "Ooh, I don't know if I want to do this. This is kind of scary." He took them out of their game. Another question I have, is Boston point guard Marcus Smart healthy? Remember, he turned that ankle really, really hard against Miami. Boston needs him to defend and defend at a really high level. If that ankle isn't 100%, we're going to see it as this series rolls on. Now, when the Boston offense faces the Warriors defense, there are a couple things you should look for. Can the veteran big man, Al Horford, continue to lead the Celtics? Can he score more than the 2 points he had in game two? Because when he is good, when he's scoring inside, then he can also step outside. He can hit that 20 to 25 footer pretty consistently, and that clears space for his teammates to slash the basket. We know what the Warriors are going to do. They're going to defend you, and then eventually they're going to start trapping you. They're going to trap ball screens. They're going to try to blitz you. They're going to try to force the ball to lesser shooters, taking what they hope are contested shots, and see if you can knock them down. The question will Boston be disciplined enough? Will they be tough enough to not take what Golden State gives them? Because as a former coach, I never want to hear the phrase, "But coach, I was open." Okay, but you're open for a reason. Don't take what the defense gives you. Take what we want. Will Boston be disciplined enough to take the shot they want, not the shot that Golden State gives them? Then we go to the other end. When the Warriors offense is going against the Celtics defense, remember, Golden State, they're really not a very big team. At times, they will go at Draymond Green and they'll put him at center and they'll just play small ball. And while it forces you to chase them because they are so small, you have to look at it and say, okay, we're going to have to chase you. That might be tough, but we can attack your lack of size too, because the Warriors aren't big. In order for the Warriors to really hang in this series, I think they're going to have to play big. They're going to have to hide their lack of size. And I want to see how Golden State continues to play the pick and roll. Sometimes they will switch that pick and roll and they feel like they have the people to do that. They'll even do it with the big man, Kevon Looney, and they'll put him out on a ball handler. If he does okay doing that, maybe you stick with it. But can Boston make them pay for some of those switches they make? Look, when we get down to this series, and I'm going to pick a winner here in just a minute, I believe this series is going to come down to two things. And I think they're very, very simple. I think we've seen them in both games so far. Who can knock down the three-point shot? Because in game one, that was Boston. Now, don't get me wrong. Steph did it early, and then the Warriors couldn't really do it late. But Boston was the one knocking down those shots. In game two, we saw the Warriors knocking down everything. And here's the big one. Who can force turnovers? Because if Golden State is playing sloppy at the offensive end, if they're turning it over, I don't believe their defense is good enough to carry them. We know Boston is going to play sloppy at the offensive end. They do that a lot. They turn the ball over way too much. But they're usually good enough defensively to get away with that. Keep turning it over against Golden State, you're going to be in for a long, long night. Because then you're hoping that you can keep them from knocking down some of those long-range shots. I also want to watch two players. Well, I want to watch more than that. But I want to watch Al Horford for Boston. Remember, he had that great game one, and then he completely disappeared for game two. He has to be a presence at both ends of the floor in order for Boston to really be able to compete with the Warriors. And then for Golden State, I want to watch Jordan Poole. Because again, he was a no-show in game one. Game two, he bounced back. But here's what I want to see with Jordan Poole. Can Poole make plays when the game is still in the balance? Because right now, he seems to be the kind of player, because he's so young, that he's kind of tight when the game is tight. He doesn't really want to shoot, doesn't always compete, doesn't always contribute. Then, when the game starts to blow open, Steph's hitting threes, Draymond's getting garbage pickup points, you're starting to see Wiggins drive to the basket and get scores, all of a sudden you'll see Poole come in and be like, "Oh yeah, let me shoot, bang, bang, bang," and he hits a few shots. I want to know, can you hit those shots when the Warriors need them? Not when they're just frosting on top. I want to see, can you make clutch plays when the game hasn't yet been decided? And I'm not so sure about that. I think those two players are absolutely pivotal for their teams. And also, the other one I really want to watch, will Klay Thompson ever do much of anything? Because he's been MIA in pretty much both of these games so far. And you can see Steve Kerr is trying to get him going. And he's really, really struggling to get anything going. Right now, can we honestly say Klay Thompson is one of the five best players for the Warriors? I'm not sure. Could we see Klay Thompson end up sitting down in this series if he doesn't step up his game a little bit? I will give him this, though. He is always a threat. So you do have to guard him. But at some point, he's going to have to knock down some shots. He hasn't done that yet. And if he doesn't, I think you're going to see Boston eventually go, okay, he's going to have to prove it. And he hasn't done that yet. Going to be very, very interesting to see how this series will play out. You know, I've really struggled with who to take in the series. Because when I look at the two teams, I think Boston is just physically better. I think they're stronger. I think they're bigger. I think they're younger. I think physically they're just a little bit better. But I think Golden State is just tougher mentally. And for that reason, I am going to take the Golden State Warriors to win the series in seven games. You know, I just hope we get a few close games, maybe a few memorable games, and a few memorable performances. And I really, really hope that at the end of the series, the story is not the poor officiating and the story is not the poor TV ratings, because that would be too bad, because I think this should be a very, very entertaining series. Okay, coming back, we still need to get over to our Daily Dose Top 5. You know, the 2020 NBA Finals have gotten off to a little bit of a slow start in that TV ratings department. Well, is this just a weird exception, or are we starting to see a trend? We're going to be looking at that when we get back. Now, as we do so many weeks here at the Daily Dose, we need to get over to our Daily Dose Top 5. The NBA Finals are now two games in, and we will get Game 3 tonight. But, you know, these finals are starting a little slow TV ratings-wise. We talked about that a little bit earlier in the show. Now, maybe these NBA Finals are going to get going. They're going to improve. They're going to rally. But it feels like right now, people are a little bit annoyed with the NBA, and I think it's for a few reasons. For one, I do think the NBA's politics have been divisive. Maybe you love their politics and you're all in, but I know that probably 50% of people don't love them, and they're not going to watch because of it. You know, the NBA, they have a lot of people, whether it's players, whether it's their commissioner, whether it's their coaches, they have a lot of people telling us what we should do. They tell us how horrible the US of A is, and yet they are fully in bed with China, a country, I might add, that literally has slave labor. So those political views aren't going to help. But it isn't just that. The games themselves have been primarily boring. Shot selection is terrible. Defense is sometimes an urban myth. NBA officials control way too much of the game with their bizarrely terrible calls. The final 2 minutes of games last forever because there are so many timeouts and so many fouls and so many reviews. And then if one team jumps out to a lead, it seems like the other team starts just resting for the next game. And that makes it a very kind of rec league experience. And I don't know if you've noticed, but going to rec leagues or watching rec league games on TV, not nearly as popular as you might think it is. Hey, these NBA finals, they have a chance to be among the worst watched finals ever. And I don't really understand it because, like we've talked about today, this should be a good matchup. Now, we will see if that changes. We will see if it gets better. But today, we are going to count down the Daily Dose Top 5 Worst NBA Finals, well, at least in terms of TV ratings. Now, a couple of caveats on our Top 5 today. One, keep in mind, the NBA didn't even always air the finals live. So we're only tracking since like 1982, because a lot of those finals, they were shown late at night on tape delay. You weren't even watching them live, so you can't really count those. And I'm going to do the NBA a little bit of a favor today. As a favor to the NBA, I am going to completely throw out the COVID bubble year back in 2020 when we had the bizarre matchup of the Los Angeles Lakers, who beat the Miami Heat in an awful series that had no fans in the stands and only got like 7 million viewers per game. They had a television share of just 4%, which means, if you're not sure what that television share means, what it means, of all the TVs that were on, out of 100%, 4% were on the NBA Finals. For reference, an episode of like Young Sheldon gets 4%. So we're just going to throw out that COVID year. We're going to pretend that year never happened. You're welcome, alien Adam Silver. We're going to ignore that ever happened. But with that aside, and just counting since 1982, here are the worst NBA finals in terms of TV ratings. We start off at number five. And you know, one of the common threads that you're going to see on this list today, it's pretty simple. Small market teams. While we get sick of the large markets, make no mistake, a series that has a Boston or a Los Angeles or a New York or a Houston is going to generate a much bigger audience than when you get a small market team that just doesn't bring the fans that those bigger cities have. And so a few of these lower rated series, you'll notice, will have smaller market teams involved. And that is the case here at number five. Because back in 2009, the Los Angeles Lakers had Phil Jackson coaching them. They had Kobe Bryant. They had Pau Gasol. They had Lamar Odom. And those three at that time, honestly, they were at the top of their powers. They had rolled to the finals by beating Utah, Houston, and Denver. And now they would probably be squaring off against a young LeBron James and the Cleveland Cavaliers, who had the best record in the Eastern Conference. Well, hey, Kobe versus LeBron? That might be a pretty good series to watch. Unfortunately for everyone, Dwight Howard and the Orlando Magic crashed the party. They upset the Cavaliers and they went to the NBA Finals instead. Let's be honest. It was a big letdown. And the Orlando Magic, they really didn't have a great team. They had Dwight Howard. But after that, I mean, their second leading scorer was Rashard Lewis. They had Jameer Nelson. Not a real strong team. The Lakers dominated the Magic. They knocked them out in just five games, and nobody watched. The 2009 NBA Finals generated an average share of just 8.4%. Again, of the 100% of TVs on, just 8.4% were tuned to those NBA Finals. They only got 14.3 million fans per game. That's not great. That's pretty bad. And the 2009 NBA Finals come in today at number five. We move next to number four. And we have another smaller market team that is going to make its first appearance today. But trust me on this, they're going to be back a number of times. We go back to 2005, where the Phoenix Suns posted the best record in the West, and the Miami Heat were the strongest team in the East. But in the playoffs, the Detroit Pistons were actually just a few years removed from winning a championship themselves, and they still had a few of those pieces remaining. Chauncey Billups, Richard Hamilton, Tayshaun Prince, and Ben Wallace led the Pistons past Miami and onto the NBA Finals, where they would meet another team that had also just won a title just 2 years before. But it was a team that was very good, don't get me wrong, but was also smaller market and also not always that exciting, let's say. But the San Antonio Spurs had rolled through the Western Conference. They beat Denver, they beat Seattle, and they beat Phoenix. San Antonio had Tony Parker. They had Tim Duncan. They had Manu Ginobili. But when the Spurs met the Pistons in the finals, no one was all that interested in it. Detroit was a little bit older. And San Antonio, well, they weren't necessarily all that old, but they played like they were older. They played like a bunch of old guys at the rec center. And for some reason, the draw of textbook bank shots and walk it up basketball didn't really excite anybody at all. The series actually did go seven games. The Spurs scraped out an 81-74 win in Game 7 for the title. Yeah, quite a shootout. The 2005 NBA Finals managed an 8.2% share. There were just 12.5 million fans watching per game. That comes in today at number 4. Okay, so those first two entries were pretty bad. Trust me, these last three entries are going to get worse. We arrive at number 3, where we go back to 2003 and a familiar subject today, because in 2003, the San Antonio Spurs were again the top team in the West with their very solid, very blue collar style of bank shot basketball. Meanwhile, over in the East, we actually got a little bit of a surprise, because the New Jersey Nets with Jason Kidd and Richard Jefferson and Kenyon Martin and Kerry Kittles somehow made it to the NBA Finals. So we got blue collar versus, well, honestly, versus a bunch of players that no one really cared all that much about. And more importantly, a group of players that we all knew there was no way they could hang with the San Antonio Spurs. So why in the world would we watch the 2003 NBA Finals? Yeah, we didn't. San Antonio beat the Nets in six games by an average score of 87-82. Yeah, not the most entertaining brand of basketball. And as a result, so many fans looked at it and said, yeah, that's not how I'm going to spend my evening. I'll go watch something else. The 2003 NBA Finals scored an average share of just 6.5% and only 9.8 million fans per game. Hey, the San Antonio Spurs were a really good basketball team. Unfortunately, they were really, really bad for TV ratings. Their 2003 version comes in today at number 3. We drain a little bit more out of the pool and we arrive at number 2. Where, yes, sorry to San Antonio and to your big old women.
Listen, I'm telling you the truth. I think it's a great city. Mm-hmm. I think they got the best organization in the NBA, but they do have some big old women. I mean, come on now.
But you are on the list yet again today, because back in 2007, the Spurs were once again rolling along with Duncan, with Parker, and with Ginobili. But this year, they would run into another team that also didn't really have any star power, because LeBron James had managed to lead the Cleveland Cavaliers to the NBA Finals. And a lot of people look back at this Cleveland team and they say, hey, that is LeBron's greatest accomplishment. Because remember, he took a team with a supporting cast of Drew Gooden and Daniel Gibson and Sasha Pavlovich and somehow got them to the NBA Finals. Hey, make no mistake, some of that was LeBron's greatness. It really was. He drug a very, very underwhelming team all the way to the NBA Finals. And yet, some of that was also due to the fact that the Eastern Conference, I don't know how else to say it, they were flaming hot garbage. The best team in the conference was the aging Detroit Pistons. And the Cavs did manage to beat them. But never forget that the Cleveland Cavaliers that year also got to play the 500 New Jersey Nets in the second round and the 500 Washington Wizards in the first round. Okay, so the Cavs endured that murderer's row. They made it to the finals against, once again, those highly efficient but really, really boring San Antonio Spurs, and the Cleveland Cavaliers got swept in 4 straight games. You know, that series, honestly, it was over so fast, people didn't even get a chance to turn their TVs on. The 2007 NBA Finals had just a 6.2% share. They averaged 9.2 million viewers per game. That is horrible. The 2007 NBA Finals comes in today at number 2. So we arrive at the number 1 worst NBA Finals based only on TV ratings. And again, we didn't count the bubble year, because that was a complete disaster. And so we're going to be nice and not count it. And we can't count the years prior to 1982 because they really weren't keeping true stats. And a lot of times the game weren't live, so we can't really count those. But we have our number one worst rated NBA Finals ever. And we go back to just last year. And we got a matchup, honestly, I thought might generate a little interest. The Phoenix Suns had improved defensively. We knew they could score. But when they got point guard Chris Paul, he changed them defensively. They also had good young players, Devin Booker, DeAndre Ayton. Hey, the Suns beat the top seed in the West, the Utah Jazz. Meanwhile, over in the East, the Milwaukee Bucks had perennial MVP Giannis Antetokounmpo. He had Chris Middleton, Drew Holiday, Brooke Lopez. The Milwaukee Bucks versus the Phoenix Suns looked like it could be entertaining, and at times it was. Phoenix won the first two games. Everyone thought, hey, this might be going seven, because if Milwaukee wins the next two, then we've got a best of three. This could be really, really fun. But after Phoenix won those first two, Milwaukee rolled off four straight wins to close out the series in just six games. Once again, Chris Paul was injured. Seems like he always is. Now, I don't know what it was. Maybe the fans were mad at the NBA still. Or maybe they were sick of the boring games or the lousy officiating. Or maybe it was just COVID hangover. Whatever it was. But the 2021 NBA Finals had just a 5.2 average share. And they only managed to get 9.9 million fans to watch each game in that series. Now, the NBA has a problem whether they want to admit it or not. Yes, COVID bit them, but it bit everyone else too. And don't forget, there are so many other factors at play here. The politics, the reffing, the small market teams, the fact that it seems like, honestly, everyone kind of hates LeBron James when he goes, the ratings do drop a little bit. The last 3 years have had some really, really bad ratings, and we can look at those and say, well, hey, it was just weird COVID stuff. It was just weird small market stuff. That's what screwed it up. But that's not the case this year. This year, we have Golden State, the Bay Area. That's a huge market. Versus Boston, again, a huge market. This series should be giant. And yet the ratings have been terrible again. Remember, Game 1 had a 6.3 share average and only 11.9 million viewers. Here is something else I want you to think about. The worst rated Super Bowl ever in the history of the NFL was Super Bowl I. You know, back when no one even knew what a Super Bowl was. Super Bowl I pulled a share of 36 and it had 24.4 million viewers. Oh, but wait. Because remember that Super Bowl I was actually shown simultaneously on both CBS and NBC at the same time. And they each got about the same numbers. So we can basically double those numbers. That bumps that share number up in the high 60s and up near 50 million viewers. Ouch. The NFL, even in its worst years, crushes the NBA. Hey, they can try to spin it however they want. The National Basketball Association needs to get their house in order. Because as you can see, from the trend that is going on in the NBA Finals, it is a mess. They have a problem. They need to fix their league. Hey, next week on The Dose, I'm actually chasing a guest that is involved in college football in a very, very unique way and has a very unique story. You've probably heard the story. We're going to tell it to you a little bit more close and a little bit more in person. Trust me, I really think you're going to enjoy hearing next week's show. Be sure you tune in and be sure you let a friend know to do the same. Hey, I want to say thank you to each and every one of you for listening to The Daily Dose every week. Thank you for the emails. Thank you for the texts. Thank you for the tweets. Thank you for going over to DailyDoseSports.com and checking out the new things going up there every week. But more than anything, thank you so much for sharing the show, for sharing the videos, for sharing the articles with someone that you know. We absolutely love it when you do that. Have to say thank you to JSP. Could not do any of this without you. I will see you all next Wednesday. Have a great week, everybody.
Listen, I'm telling you the truth. I think it's a great city. Mm-hmm. I think they got the best organization in the NBA. But they do have some big old women, though. I mean, come on now.